You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
Good morning and welcome to Friday's OTB AM. It is a packed show as always for you on a Friday, and as always, I'm delighted to say, we're joined in studio by Off the Balls primary OTB AM presenter Owen Shane.
Primary, yes, and you know, you elevate from primary to post-primary to secondary and then on to university, and I'm delighted to be joined in studio by our university presenter Adrian Barry this morning.
I'm glad that you've sought to seek the negative in what I was saying there, Owen. Obviously I was insinuating your importance to OTB AM, but I mean, you've managed to skew that in a very Irish way, that you've sort of spun the negative on it.
Well, you know, it's a great day to be Irish, of course, this morning, so I'm going to do everything that I possibly can to get into the psyche of the Irish person, because, yeah, you know, we're all proud to be Irish today.
The hockey's great. You're the anti Ronan O'Gara, by the way. We might talk about that a little bit later on. He's a glass half full man, a little bit more than half full, actually, as it turns out, as he's been speaking about this morning. But yeah, we're all about the hockey, Owen. It's an unbelievable story, really. I have to admit, I didn't get to see too much of the game yesterday. I was in here and I was trying to get out of here, and I caught some of the penalties, but it was, like, it's an exceptional story. It's one of the, in a summer that keeps on giving, it's one of the stories of the summer, isn't it? It's bloody incredible stuff.
It is. It is remarkable. And, like, let's call a spade here. We're all very, very happy this morning for having got one over India. Like, there was a sense of surely lightning can't strike twice and we can't beat a superpower once again of the hockey world. Of course, a nation with whatever, 1.5 billion times. I did the maths this morning, actually.
Go on, yeah.
They've got 277 times the population of Ireland.
Wow.
So, you know, that is something. You think of all the great Indians in the past. You think of the likes of Gandhi. You think of the great architectural wonders like the Taj Mahal. And then you remember, with a result like that last night, we have the Cliffs of Moher and we have Michael D. Higgins and we have great things ourselves, including a great hockey team. And it was a fantastic penalty shootout last night. Aisha McFerrin, one of the best goalkeeping performances we've seen in any sport all year. And it's very fitting, in fact, that we're playing Spain next. I hope that goes to a penalty shootout. You know, revenge for Gaius Mendieta in 2002 is all I'm thinking.
The man to do commentary on it, yeah.
And I'm hereby, I think it's especially fitting that we're playing Spain, because I'm hereby deeming David De Gea to be football's version of Aisha McFerrin.
Right.
Like, that is the gauge that every other goalkeeper should be going for right now, because it was a masterful performance from her last night. It was, it gave us a platform to finish the thing off, and yeah, it was superb. It was, like, in reality, we're all kind of getting reacquainted to a sport that we dip in and out of at different intervals, at different parts of our lives, whenever Ireland are going well. And do you know what I'm really happy with is that there is no such thing as any hockey snobbery going on. All the genuine hockey fans on Twitter and all that are like, it's great to have all these people on the bandwagon, which is the way it all should be.
Yeah, so it's interesting to see how they sort of harness the success of the hockey team over the next while. And I admired the fact that you sort of initially in your comment there sort of, you were pretending that you would sort of pluck these figures from the sky, but then you just thought, actually, no, I'll just...
No, I did it on my calculator on my computer. It's probably still out of my computer.
It's the national sport of India, obviously, hockey.
Is it?
Yeah.
Not cricket?
I read yesterday it was the national sport of hockey. I was as surprised as you are now.
Right, okay.
But having said all of that, the women's game is absolutely non-existent.
So well, they're still ranked 10th in the world.
But the women's game, they pay absolutely no heed to whatsoever. And that probably tells you a little bit about society there. But
yeah. But just one last thing before we move on. Just looking at Spain and their results in big tournaments in the past, like, obviously it will be another shock for Ireland to beat them. It wouldn't be a huge shock. Like, this is their joint best finish at a World Cup already. Their best finish to date was fourth place in 2006. Other than that, it's been usually 10th, 11th, 6th, 5th previously. Spain, this is. But then you get into the Summer Olympics and it's a similar story. Fourth in 2000, 10th in 2004. And their best ever achievement in any Summer Games or any World Cup happened to be the games that they hosted in 1992 when they won the thing. So I don't know about you, but the first thing I'm doing after this show is getting on YouTube to see some of the refereeing decisions in 1992. It's such a happy coincidence that they managed to win the Olympics in that occasion.
Well, look, I won't do that, but if you're going to do it, like, you can just let me know if there was...
I'm creating a siege mentality here, Adrian. Yeah. All I'm saying is that I'm fully sure that the refereeing gods smiled well on Spain on that summer occasion in 1992, and karma dictates that they might smile brightly on us on Saturday afternoon.
We shall see. I mean, it is our home tournament after all, with England now out, so that's the way these things work. Hockey, it turns out, it's amazing. Here's how it went down at last night's show.
Chloe Watkins with a chance. Chloe Watkins
Oh, you have her!
Chloe Watkins has done it. Ireland are through to the semi-finals.
I'm going to love
of the Hockey World Cup. Oh, look at the celebrations! This fantastic stuff over in England. Graham Shaw and his coaching team celebrate together. All the players run to celebrate as well. Chloe Watkins, the hero. Ireland win the penalty shootout 3-1, and they are heading to the semi-finals of the World Cup, where they will take on Spain at the weekend. We are going to have reaction from the Ireland camp before the end of the show.
I mean, it's just like Jeff and Cammy, really, when you think about it. The two lads, sort of three lads going at it there.
Yeah, you can do your coming up and then I can
Let's do the coming up. Right, busy show for you today between now and 9 o'clock or thereabouts. We're going to be discussing Irish hockey very shortly. We're going to hear some of the coaching ticket around last night's show, and we're going to be joined by the assistant coach that is coming your way very shortly. We're also going to, I'm delighted to say, be joined by the former Ireland goalkeeper, Nicky Simmons. So that's all coming your way very shortly right here on OTB AM. We're going to be delving into the back pages, let you know exactly what's happening there. We're going to be joined on the line to chat to Lee Keegan. We're going to check in with what exactly the hell he's been doing with himself now that he's had a bit of time to sort of kick back over the last few weeks, and obviously preview a pretty bloody big weekend of Super 8's football to decide exactly who's going into the All-Ireland semi-finals and exactly who they're going to be meeting. When they get that far, we're going to also play a very special feature that our own Andy Lee has been out and about chatting to retired boxer Seamus McDonagh, who's had an unbelievably interesting career, an unbelievably interesting life. So that's coming your way before 9 o'clock this morning. And we're also going to be joined on the line, as we have been all week, by Johnny Ward, who's at Ballybrit for the Galway races. So he's going to mark your card for the day ahead and reflect as well a little bit on yesterday's action. So that's all coming your way. I think we're going to do the back pages now. I want to give everybody a bit of a flavour of what's happening there. It's a pretty mixed bag.
OTB
AM. Thanks to Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a dedicated call centre.
It's all gone swimmingly this morning. It's 7 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Friday morning, and we're delighted to have you along with us. Get your comments coming into us, and we'll bring those to air for you. Right, what's happening in the back pages this morning? We're going to start with the Irish Independent right here, and it's hockey all the way. And it's both goalkeepers pictured here. Golden Girls, Aoife McFerrin on the right there with number 19, and the subkeeper Grace O'Flanagan after that quarterfinal win yesterday at the Hockey World Cup. And the first choice goalkeeper wears 19 and the reserve goalkeeper wears 1.
Yeah, what's that about?
I'm not sure. We might establish that later on. I mean, maybe it's the dumbest question of all time when it comes to hockey, but it was something that jumped out at me.
But she's quite young, obviously, McFerrin, so maybe she just kind of skipped ahead at the start of this tournament.
Possibly, yeah. Ryan, exit points tip in different direction, writes Colin Keyes here. Michael Ryan stepping down as the, with some surprise, of course, as the Tipperary hurling manager. And Rory O'Connor with an interesting story here. Limerick used rugby hero Earls as secret weapon for All-Ireland bids. So, in the way that Brezzy had been in chatting to Michael Ryan's former Tipperary hurling manager Michael Ryan's team, they've been using Keith Earls to go in and give them a bit of a pep talk. Seems like a pretty obvious, wise thing to do.
Yeah, Conor Murray, the man spilling the beans on that at Munster Adidas launch yesterday. Absolutely wise decision, although Conor Murray does point out that perhaps Irish rugby players aren't the best placed people to, you know, talk about getting to semi-finals or succeeding in semi-finals and stuff like that. Obviously, very much tongue-in-cheek on that occasion. Like, Keith Earls is a great shout. Like, it's such an obvious thing right there in front of you that for John Kiely to actually bring in some sort of expertise of play in high-pressure situations that, you know, you think of the last two England games and the end of the Six Nations over the past couple of years, big occasions in Thomond Park. Keith Earls really, in terms of putting in clutch performances, is a man you want around. And it's a fantastic acquisition just to bring him in for a couple of chats. I presume that's what it's been.
Yeah.
And he's gone off about his own business again. But great shout by Kylie.
I think even more than that, he's a guy who, over the last couple of years, as he's had the conversations on here with us about it, about how he has mature reflection now in his career, that he's a guy who, even over the last couple of seasons, has sort of understood the idea of taking control of his own career and not been necessarily a sort of bystander when it comes to his own career, like taking control and taking charge. And like, that's a fantastic thing that, I mean, even at the stage of his career, he says himself that it was possibly something he should have done a bit earlier. So hopefully that will resonate with that Limerick team.
There is a thing of the Irish rugby, the national rugby team, being one of the most beloved teams in Ireland, but also in the spotlight constantly. They are celebrities, the Irish rugby players. Everybody knows them. So dealing with that from a Limerick perspective is a very new challenge because they haven't been in All-Ireland for 11 years. John Kiely, obviously, don't want to use the word media ban, but has clamped down on media dealings. And I guess dealing with that
kind
spotlight
ban, but,
is very much at the forefront of Kiely's mind, and bringing in a national rugby player, a star of Limerick, is a very good move.
The Irish Examiner this morning, meanwhile, it's again, as you might expect, it's hockey all the way here. Embracing success, Ireland gear up for World Cup semi-final after a shootout drama. It's a good photograph that captures the mood after yesterday's win over India. Ronan O'Gara is back. 8 months in Christchurch has changed me as a person, he says. He should have a bit of a pep talk. He needs to be the Keith Earls to the Limerick Hurlers for you, I think, Owen, in the way that he's writing this morning about the new positive Ronan O'Gara and how he reflects on Ireland as a nation. That's the way we are. A glass half empty race of warriors.
Yeah, I guess we are.
Well, I think there's something in that.
I'm certainly glass half full this morning. I mean, I've literally said Michael D. Higgins is better than Mahatma Gandhi this morning, so I think I'm a glass half full person.
Yeah. Tipperary Hunt, new coaching ticket as Ryan steps down. Reflections as well on Dundalk's exit from the Europa League after their heavy defeat to Larnaca yesterday. That's the Irish Examiner. And the Irish Times, meanwhile, Aaron Will leads Ireland to unprecedented heights. It's the reflections here in the Irish Times this morning. Again, more scenes of joy. A lot of them have gone with different photographs. This is one surprising thing. There hasn't been one sort of standout snap that's dominated the back pages this morning. Shaw hails McFerrin for goalkeeping heroics. So we're going to catch up with the Ireland assistant coach a little bit later on. Lambark win, a huge moment in the history of Irish hockey, writes Johnny Watterson there, who's been writing about the hockey all this week. And Murray says that Carberry's arrival will be key for Munster in one of the most obvious statements of the year so far. The rugby season hasn't even begun, and I'm going to put that in as obvious headline of the season.
Maybe Joey Carberry ends up being fourth choice out half for Munster. I mean, just... maybe that was the plan all along.
You think?
Maybe that's the chat they were having with Noosa 4. Is like, you know what, we really need a fourth choice. We need someone to give JJ Hanrahan and Ian Keatley a kick up the behind. And Noosa 4 is like, well, there's this guy at Leinster you may or may not have heard of. He can sit in your bench all season.
Times Ireland edition, actually in the front page here, to be fair to them, lead with the hockey story there. And obviously on the back as well. And Carberry can take Munster to next level is the other big headline there. Obviously in full agreement, Kieran O'Rourke there with Owen's point about Joey Carberry's position as fourth choice Munster out half. And the Racing Post this morning, let's be frank, everybody's getting very excited about the new Derby County manager because the odds have been slashed from 18 to 1 to 14 to 1 down to 9 to 2
For
promotion from the Championship. So
interesting.
That's what we see. He cuts a dashing figure as a manager. He doesn't look very manager-like actually just yet, but
He looks more physio, doesn't he? He looks like he's about to run on, kind of treat a player on the pitch and risk the wrath of Jose Mourinho.
That's his style. Maybe he's more of a Brian Clough type character. We'll see.
We will certainly see. The back page of the Irish Daily Mail this morning is Ireland's roar of pride. That's the hockey story. And tip and turmoil, says Philip Lanigan. Premier's summer of woe goes on as management quit. The back page of the Sunday this morning is William Fury. This is star calls in lawyers over transfer letter forgery. This is an interesting story this morning. Furious William is to sue over a forged letter authorising his transfer from Chelsea. So a letter's after doing the rounds where one agent says to another agent that I have claimed the rights of Willian. He is my now my client and my property. Mm. And Willian has signed it, but it's not Willian's signature, it's a forged signature. And Willian took a screenshot, put it on Instagram and was like, this is a disgrace, so I'm going to sue whoever did this. As you were pointing out before we came on air, why would he do this? Why would he draw attention to this?
Doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
The transfer deadline is next week, Adrian, that's why.
Exactly.
Back page of the Sun is Jolly Hockey Tricks. That is, I did already say that was the Sun, but that is their hockey lead.
Headline of the day on the hockey, I would say.
Yeah, I think so. It's a good one. As you say, no repetitive pictures at all, actually, which is interesting. Back page of the Mirror is a football exclusive, paid in Chelsea. That's Zaha, who is determined to quit Palace for a big money move to Stamford Bridge. Is that not your tab of the morning, though? No? Paid in Chelsea?
Yeah, it would be, only that I couldn't care less about the story.
Right, okay, fair enough. It's pretty harsh. Wilfred Zaha, get in touch. Back page of the Irish Daily.
Paid in Chelsea fan, on that area.
Well, I would have thought you were, but...
I have to say, I watch as much of that as I do of Love Island, so, you know.
bit of both. A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
None of either column.
Flicking from 3E to whatever, ITV4 or whatever it may be.
Doesn't happen.
Well, you know, there's time.
You love Isle of Man?
I would have been if there was no World Cup, I suspect.
The question is, really, right?
I suspect that would have been a flaw in my character that would have been exposed this summer. But fortunately, the World Cup covered it up, but I didn't do a Dave McIntyre going back.
Go on.
Dave went back and watched it like a series of 24.
Anybody who sort of ditches out going to Kerry games to go to some itty-bitty concert is probably going to be a Love Island fan, to be fair. That's
the most offensive thing I've ever been levelled with. The back page of the Irish Daily Star is Court in a Trap. Chelsea refused to budge. That is a Thibaut Courtois transfer scenario. And Ireland go semi-sonic. That's a good headline. As Ireland beat India 3-1 on penalties. Then just to round up things, the UK titles kind of include this little story here. Double Dutch. England beaten by impressive Netherlands in the World Cup. What's that I hear? That Ireland have gone further than England in the World Cup. Is hockey coming home? I think I've heard it correctly. And it's up here as well. The cricket gets prominence, but don't worry about that cricket. Look at the top right there. England's dream is over. Holders Holland send the host crashing out. That's right, Holland into the semi-final. England not into the semi-final. Guess who is in the semi-final that England aren't? Ireland. That's who.
Don't worry about that cricket story there, says Owen, having obviously not read it, so to bring any detail on it.
But, well, it was Coley, Captain Colossus for England.
Fair point. One other paper to bring you just before we wrap up on the newspapers, it's the Irish News This Morning performance, is Donegal Sol Focus, so obviously looking ahead to the big game at the weekend and reflections on Tyrone there as well. And clearly the hockey, which dominates everything this morning, and it is to the hockey we're going to go. We're going to be going to London in camp in just a few minutes' time. But to take us there, I want to bring you some of last night's show. We were joined on the line by the Irish captain, Katie Mullen, and coach Graham Shaw, talking to Nathan.
I'm just so proud of the girls, and I think when the final whistle went, I looked around and so many faces were smiling and knew that we were going to win that shootout with Aisha McFerrin in goals. She's incredible and she's very hard to score against. So we stayed very calm. We've had those penalties before, and we've kind of got a process that we stick to try and keep things as calm as possible. So the girls just took themselves aside and got themselves calm and composed and feeling positive. And then, you know, Aisha likes her space as well, so she executes and we give ourselves the best chance.
Can you in any way describe the feeling when the final penalty went in, when Chloe scored and Aisha's making the saves? Is there any way to describe, with your long career with Ireland, what it meant to you?
It's definitely a career high, and I just was so proud of the girls. Every game we play is such a team effort. There's no one that puts more on the pitch than the person beside them, and it's just, it's a real team effort, and yeah, I think we all felt on top of the world.
Just so proud of the girls. It's just to win in the shootout is bury these demons from 2015 and not qualifying for Rio, so I'm absolutely over the moon. Couldn't be prouder of them.
Had you spoken much about that, about the possibility, as is so often the case, that these games can go to penalties and making sure that they're not affected by what had happened in the past? Is that something you thought about ahead of the penalties?
We didn't really bring up 2015, but we've been training them a lot. And what we tend to do is when we play a game against in a test series, we tend to do them after the game, regardless, against the opposition, just to get that practice. But listen, it's very, very hard to replicate pressure, and that pressure is just extreme. So I thought they performed brilliantly. I knew if we scored two, we'd win, because Aisha in goal is just, is incredible at them, and I knew once the second one went in, it's going to take something special to beat us then.
Yeah, what a story. Aisha McFerrin, 22 years of age and a hero at a World Cup.
Yeah, and listen, we've known about her since she was 18 years of age. I've been watching her since she was 18. She is top drawer, and it's just so pleasing to see her do it on the world stage, because sometimes when the pressure comes on, it can be difficult, and as a goalkeeper, you can be really, really, you know, not have much to do all the time, and then all of a sudden, you need a moment. And she's been superb, absolutely superb since the first game, and I'm so happy for her that she was able to show her what she's about and win the shootout.
Yeah, 8:05 on this Friday morning, and it really has been the story of the summer in terms of international Irish sport. Graeme Shaw on the show last night. I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line now by the Ireland assistant coach, Arlene Boyles. Good morning to you, Arlene. Thanks for taking the call.
Good morning. How are you?
All is good. I sort of did wonder to begin with, when you've just won the biggest game in the sports history and you've the next biggest game in the sports history upcoming tomorrow, how you celebrate that win last night?
Quietly, would you believe? The girls have a very quick turnaround now, so recovery is key. So they came home, went through the routine as normal, went through the physio routine, and we aim to try and get them in bed by a decent hour and turn their phones off. It's probably the biggest challenge we had last night, but they were buzzing by the time they came back to the hotel. So I think the biggest thing is sleep for them now, and we'll go and do recovery today.
It must be a battle to do even just that. That obviously there must be an appetite there for players to jump on Twitter and jump on their phones and text their mates and sort of try and soak up what's been achieved almost.
Oh yeah, I think management are worse. It is. I mean, we talked a lot about social media and what the impact could be if we far in this tournament, and they've been very diligent with it and been very good with it. I think it's very difficult not to give them, you know, their moment of sunshine last night, and they know exactly what they want from this World Cup, and I think that's been proven over the last few weeks.
Before we look ahead, I know Graeme Shaw mentioned the performance of Aisha McFerrin there last night, but the coolness and the calmness for such a young player last night, was this something that you guys had sort of expected, or has it come as a surprise to you?
No, it doesn't come to a surprise to us, to be honest with you. She's, as Graeme said last night, it's just getting these girls on a world stage to show exactly what they can do. And Aisha McFerrin is one of them. She's proved that she can, you know, control a corner. She's proved that she can control a defence. She's proved that she can take shots in open play. And we all know what she's capable of in run-ins, because our girls have to practice against that. So that's, you know, it's advantageous for us, because she's incredibly difficult to beat. But she's in another place at the minute, and she's enjoying every moment of it.
How much video work would Aisha have done into the Indian takers yesterday? Because it seemed like she had her plan and she very much stuck to it. And as Adrian said, it was very cool and calculated, her goalkeeping.
Yeah, they do a lot of video work. We all do a lot of video work, both goalkeepers. Aisha as well had everything. You know, she had watched India. She had watched so much sort of corner stuff. She's watched run-ins. And yeah, I mean, it's all come true for her. She's well coached by Nigel Henderson, who obviously looks after Davy Hart as well in Ireland. And I think he's a little bit understated for me, he's really reaping the rewards now with Aisha and Davy.
Why does she wear 19, Arlene?
It's a number that she was given a while ago, and I think it's now probably a bit of a superstition for her. And she doesn't change the number. That's her number, and I think she'll keep it from now on.
All right, yeah, because we wondered about that, whether it was a pecking order thing pre-tournament, but it's almost a bit of superstition.
Yeah, it is. It was a number that was just simply available to her when she came into the squad. And now, good luck trying to get it off her.
When you met up pre-tournament, Arlene, what were the, if you can reveal them, what were the expectations, or what were the targets that you guys had set out before you went to London?
Yeah, well, I mean, the targets were talked about, goal setting was talked about most tournaments and probably like every team. The big one was to get out of the group, to get into the crossovers, and then just see what could happen. And we did that, and we did that in spades, my goodness. Mm. To get straight into the quarterfinals was just stuff of dreams. Now we just seem to keep going. It's incredible to be part of. But yeah, we now have a semi-final against Spain tomorrow, and who knows what'll happen.
We might just drop out that line, Arlene, and try and redial you in if we can. It's just dropping off there a small bit. We'll try and re-establish that connection to London for what's an unbelievable story, really, when you think about it.
Yeah, very interesting what you were saying there about Nigel Henderson working with Aisha McFerrin and how he also works with Davy Hart, because it did strike me yesterday watching that. It's like, we have two world-class goalkeepers in both genders here. That can't be a coincidence. And it is very interesting that the one coach works with both goalkeepers. I'd be interested to hear, like, I'm sure we'll speak to Aisha after the tournament's over, but about that process of creating a world-class person in a position in both teams. It's not, obviously McFerrin is clearly a top talent, but it's clearly come as a wider culture.
Yeah, well, sure, look at the way you go.
Well, it's good to have you back. I was just what you said there about Nigel Henderson was very interesting. I just wanted to come back to that for just a moment because, like I was just saying to Adrian there a moment ago, I'm not sure if you heard it, that it was very striking yesterday watching Aisha McFerrin and just thinking about Davy as well, and two world-class players, and McFerrin will become a household name in Irish sport, not just Irish hockey now, just like Davy Hart is. Is that a coincidence that we have two world-class goalkeepers, or is that does a lot of credit have to go to Henderson for that?
I think a lot of credit has to go to Henderson. I mean, Nigel's been around now. He was a goalkeeper himself for Ireland, and he knows. He's so diligent in organising goalkeepers and defence, for that matter, penalty corner defence. And yeah, he's non-social media, so he probably is a little bit ignorant to what is being said at the minute and how he's being talked about. But yeah, he deserves all the plaudits that come his way.
Arlene, we're going to be following Ireland's progress with great interest, and no doubt we'll speak with yourself and the rest of the coaches and the players as well. Pre-final, hopefully, as it pans out. But for the minute, thanks a million for taking the call. Best of luck tomorrow.
Thanks so much. Thanks for ringing.
Arlene Boyle's there, who's the Ireland assistant coach.
Yeah, we've just had a tweet in from David Brady to say, Ger Gilroy has just been on to me, and I'm delighted to be announced as Off the Ball's new hockey correspondent. London, here I come, and the double hockey emoji. So congratulations, David, on the new appointment. I'm delighted for you.
It's prestigious, needless to say.
You travel with DB, we'll have two outings, one to London for the World Cup semi-final and hopefully final, and then to New York next year.
We're going to talk to Nicky Simmons, who actually does know a few things about hockey. Sorry, DB. We're going to talk to Nicky Simmons before the show is out as well. Like, it'll just be interesting to talk to her about all of those sort of dynamics, slightly different conversation, and also about how Irish hockey begins to harness some of this stuff, because, like, we spoke a little bit about it this time last week when the story had started to bubble up a bit. Just that entire idea of, it's probably caught everybody a little bit by surprise. Arlene talks about the targets that were set beforehand to get to the crossovers. They bypassed the crossovers and straight into the quarters. But nobody really expected Ireland to get this far. And on that basis, how do you put some sort of a plan in place, because you're on the back foot straight away, to try and harness some of this popularity and actually grow the sport over the next 20 years.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you would be tempted, and I would always be of the opinion that when you have an achievement this great, which is getting to a World Cup semi-final from the position of being ranked 16th in the world, you should celebrate that. You should enjoy every moment. Until you look around and you see your semi-final opponents and you realise that it's Spain and that this isn't the Netherlands. This isn't even England. This isn't even India. This is Spain. This is a very beatable team. They would be considered more of
a... So not ideal is what you're saying. We're better off where there's somebody there who we shouldn't beat and got the Irish attitude.
Well, that's the thing. There was such an Irish attitude before yesterday, I would have thought. I was certainly thinking, God, we've taken down one big dog already. The worst thing you want to do is try and take down a big dog twice. Yeah. And there was a natural scepticism on my part, I'll admit, that we might not be able to beat India a second time. Mm. And they proved us all wrong. I'm sure I wasn't the only person thinking that. But Spain, judging by the ranking, judging by their previous finishes, aren't anything better than India or anything better than... Certainly not better than...
Anybody who's watching from the start...
Why wouldn't I be down in Spain? We're going to war with Spain this weekend. It is going to be all guns out for Spain on Saturday.
Yeah, but here we go. There might be something that suits us to play that India team particularly. They were the team that we beat that qualified us for the World Cup as well. And so there might be something in that. Now, like, we've obviously had other results in this World Cup and there's momentum behind us. And you say Spain are a bang average team, on as you point out.
They came 12th in the last World Cup and they didn't even qualify for the last World Cup. They came 12th in 2010. In 2008 in the Olympics, and they came 7th. In the 2016 Olympics, they came 8th. No great shakes, Adrian.
A rabble. They're a rabble.
No great shakes.
A rabble, honestly.
They're a disaster of a team.
In the vernacular. They're a cod. An absolute cod, that Spain team. Right, 8:15 on this Friday morning. We're going to talk football with Lee Keegan in just a moment. But first of all, one of the big hurling stories of the week, amongst many, but later in the week, was the fact that Michael Ryan had stepped down as Tipperary hurling manager. And last night, Dahi Regan joined us, and here's his reaction.
Mike Ryan knows what's best for Michael Ryan. I mean, if you look at Mike's career, he's been involved in three All-Ireland wins as a player in 2001, as a selector in 2010, and as the manager of the team that won in 2016. So he's put a huge amount into it. I do think it's interesting the actual content of the release where he's talking about a new direction. And it may very well be a case that you must remember in the three All-Ireland successes over a 15-year period that Mike Ryan has been involved in Tipperary. Tipperary have played in a traditional Tipperary way, which has been a direct type of hurling, and that's the kind of granite he's cut from, and that's what he understands, and he understands what makes Tipperary tick, and he understands the demands that are within Tipperary. It very well may be a case that he's looking at what's been played now, he's looking at Clare, and he's looking at Limerick, and it's possible Mike may feel that, you know, a new direction means that Tip may need to change the style of hurling. And that's not necessarily his kind of forte, to be able to change how we play. Because there's been suggestions that this year with Tipperary that it was kind of too one-dimensional, that it was just get the ball up the field and you rely then on kind of individuals. And he has great forwards with great individual skill, but that certainly wasn't enough this year. So it is possible that they've sat down collectively, taking a look at it, how they can bring Tipperary forward. And within that group dynamic with John Madden and Conor Stakelin, they may have felt that, listen, the way we're playing and the way the game has kind of moved, maybe we haven't moved with it.
Interesting stuff from Dahi Regan on the show last night. Not all that recent photograph of Dahi, it has to be said. I mean, maybe 1 or 2 years old.
Well, it gives him a bit of clout, you know. It's like he's been in the wars. He's been at the top level of the game. For anybody who obviously didn't know, I'm sure everybody realises the clout from which he speaks.
He got game.
But yeah, that's exactly the phrase that was coming to my mind as well.
Alan Proctor says, hockey's coming home. Anyone know how to drive bandwagon? All aboard, really, is the short story on that.
All aboard. We've
all become hockey experts, Owen, let's face it. You most especially.
And I'm becoming an expert in how terrible a nation Spain are as this morning is progressing. Like, I'm starting to think to myself, Enrique Iglesias, is he all that? In fact, I think he's a bit shite.
Wow.
Penelope Cruz, was she ever that good? Has she ever been a good actor?
Wow.
Like, I'm starting to think that maybe Spain is a nation of cods, Adrian.
PK. Never really.
Forget the footballers. The footballers are actually good. Let's forget about the footballers, because they'll be a caveat to my argument that Spain are a nation of cods and we will beat them on Saturday.
What's Spanish for cod? Anybody? Any Spanish speakers out there that could sort of let us know? No.
No.
It's an in joke. Anyway, it's 18 minutes past 8 on this Friday morning. We've lots of good stuff coming your way. As I said a bit earlier, we're going to talk to Nicky Simmons to reflect on that hockey goodness and to look ahead to that Spain game tomorrow as well. Like, sort of fascinated. What time is it?
I saw 2 o'clock somewhere. It was supposed to be at 4:30, but then I read in the Irish Times this morning that it's actually going to be at 2 o'clock.
Right.
So it's kind of like conflicting reports. Yeah, Ireland versus Spain at 2 o'clock, says the Irish Times, and then the Netherlands against Australia at 4:30. The final then, which will be Ireland against the Netherlands, is on at 4:30 on Sunday.
Good. Well, I look forward to that and set my reminders on it. So that's coming your way. We've also got a very special mini-doc that our own Andy Lee has been out and about in the last couple of weeks to chat with Seamus McDonagh. This is a guy that won't be on everybody's radar. He did fight Vander Holyfield at one point in his career, and as he'll tell you over the course of the documentary, that it wasn't an obvious fight necessarily for him to take on. It was a bit of a foolhardy fight by all accounts. He was stepping up in weight against one of the most highly rated boxers on the planet at that point, but it did put him one step away from a $25 million payday, and let's face it, that's got to be temptation enough. So it's really interesting story inside the ring. It's a really interesting story outside the ring as well. And Andy has sat down with Seamus McDonagh. We're going to bring that your way before 9 o'clock. So stay tuned for all of that good stuff. And Johnny Ward as well. He's still alive. He's still at Ballybrit. We're into day 5 of the Galway Festival, and there's lots of good stuff to look forward to today. Limini seems to be everybody's pick for the big one. So we're going to get Johnny's thoughts on that. I already know that he's plumped for it.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see how we go on that.
Yeah, it's been. I'm not sure how yesterday went, but certainly prior to that, it was a bit of a disaster for the punters. It's gone proper like Oxygen 2009 over there as well, I presume, with the rain, as in just mud everywhere.
Right.
So I don't quite think people are in wellies and, you know, raving, but ultimately, I presume it leads to a rather unpleasant experience in certain parts of the racecourse, but I'm sure most people are having a very, very pleasant experience.
The enclosure zone, it's the only way to go, you know yourself. It's,
well, for you, anyway, I suppose,
VIP action.
Have you ever not been a VIP at a racecourse? Have you ever not worn a top hat at a race course?
Occasionally I would have done, There was one time I didn't wear a top hat when I was about 12, maybe. I went to Roscommon races and I wouldn't have worn a top hat that day. But
and what was your opinion of the
13,
plebs?
14, I would have. What was my opinion of the plebs?
Yeah, being down with the rest of us at the rest of the race course.
You're putting yourself in with the proletariat.
I've never been in a corporate section of a race course. I've always paid my way in and, you know, done the honest thing. Give a few quid to the bookies.
Right.
You know, pay your way through the racing
the
industry.
Honest thing and lose money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're there to support the racing industry when you go to the state racing. You're not there to be one of the prawn sandwich brigade.
I did. Actually, my first prawn sandwich experience ever was at racing, bizarrely enough. And it wouldn't be a sport that I would have been madly into as a young fella. But that was my first ever corporate experience.
Whereabouts?
Ferry House.
Right.
Ferry House, yeah.
For the national?
I don't know. I absolutely no. I have no recollection what the hell we were doing there.
Clearly didn't appreciate your prawn sandwiches.
Well, what I appreciated was I was there with my parents and a couple of their friends, and one of the friends had won a significant sum of money, all of which she gave to me. So that was sort of, I was like, all right.
Why? Or like,
I think she just appreciated that she'd been invited for the day out. So
okay,
like,
sorry. Yeah,
I mean, it was way too generous, even though.
What's a prawn sandwich actually like? I've never had one.
I don't eat prawns. I think it's more of the sort of philosophy of something rather than the specifics of actually eating prawns.
Okay, fair enough.
I'm allergic to them, so I kind of think
it's worth it. It's worth it for the severe allergic reaction to say that you had a prawn sandwich once.
Ronan O'Gara, speaking of prawn sandwiches, Ronan O'Gara, I mean Cork, and
go for it.
He's back in the Examiner this morning. The rugby season is upon us, and he's been writing about how he's become a totally different person over his last 8 months, 9 months with the Canterbury Crusaders, who are into the final this weekend against one of these South African teams who I can't remember. And he's talking about how he's become a totally different person, that he has been exposed to Scott Robertson, who's the head coach of the Crusaders, and how he's just an incredibly positive guy. And as O'Gara points out, that's not a typical Irish trait, that we tend to be a bit more of the sort of glass half empty. He's saying that Robertson is, the glass is not only just half full, it's just a little bit more half full than half full all the time. O'Gara says that we're a glass half empty race of warriors.
It's a good way of putting us, and it's quite accurate. Mm. I'm interested to hear him say that, given he's been inside a professional setup here.
He makes a lot of sort of, in my career, I've never been bum, 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 bum. So like, there's a lot of career-long commentary from O'Gara, a guy who obviously has been involved in, I would say, successful Irish teams, obviously, down through the years. So
you'd imagine reflection on them. Setups with a glass that is brimming with confidence. No,
confidence is different from positivity, though.
Okay, fair enough. Even with positivity, I would say, like I think he's hit the nail on the head with the Irish public, perhaps. But with Irish high-performance setups, I would have thought that positivity would have been a big factor. I'm surprised to hear that, and like, you obviously take him at his word, so I'm surprised to hear that the Irish national team wouldn't have been brimming with confidence or an outside positivity.
I think it can be subtle enough things, like he's talking about at the Crusaders, where they go into a game against the Highlanders and they're ravaged with injury, and O'Gara goes up to Scott Robertson and he says, listen, like, if ever the Highlanders are going to beat us, it's this week, which is a pretty Irish mindset, you know. And I suppose the other thing about it is, like, they're operating in that little bubble of conversation that they don't necessarily, they never have that conversation with the rest of the players, for example. So you sort of assume that you can have that conversation at that level and then deliver a different message, obviously, to the players. But not on Scott Robertson's watch. He's like, well, actually, I don't really view it that way. I kind of think that there's some of these players who are going to get their opportunity. The bank of evidence from the other players who've got their opportunity this season is that they've stood up to the plate. I believe we can beat the Highlanders this weekend, and it's going to happen. And inevitably, they go out and hockey the Highlanders.
Yeah, the more you say that, and the more you say that it's not an Irish thing, the more I think of Gerlach Nan saying, we are going to do it.
Yeah.
So maybe it's something that isn't.
But that's notable, and that's become
notable
a
because
thing
it's positive.
Because nobody ever does it.
Sure, but yeah, it's a fair point. I just thought perhaps that was the curtain being pulled back, that one time we got to glimpse inside the mind of a high performance manager or coach or motivator. I'm surprised to hear that, but I trust that it's right. There's a lot of glass half empty people dealing in Irish sport, which is a shame.
It's a curious thing, Owen. A couple of other stories that we wanted to bring, we just wanted to reflect on. The Willian story was one that particularly caught your eye this morning. Here it is in the Sun this morning. Chelsea shocker, Willian Fury, writes Tom Barkley here. Star calls in lawyers over transfer letter forgery. You've got the details of this one on.
Yeah, so he's furious with this, and it's interesting to know the motivation behind all this. Of course, the transfer window closes next week, next Thursday, I think, at midnight. It's set to close. So a lot of people making manoeuvring attempts to get themselves out of clubs. I'm not saying Willian is one of those players. I'm just saying that
he totally
these,
is,
these
right?
two things are...
Somebody sends in a letter, they get his signature on it, and it says that I'm giving, I mean, essentially a right of attorney to this group of players to manage where my future lies. If I you know, I may get a transfer... and they can look after it, right? So who cares, right, that somebody has gone to the trouble of doing that? Like, that's some crank or whoever it is. Don't worry about it. Just, like, get the bit of paper, roll it up, chuck it in the bin, move on to your pre-season training, whatever the hell it is you're doing. The fact that you've become sort of so transfixed with this thing and you've put it up on Instagram, to me, suggests that actually maybe this is not sort of a third party that Willian doesn't know too much about, because... like, otherwise, why the hell would you get so furious about it? You can't control, ultimately, some crank who decides that they're going to try and sort of create a bit of a story, or, like, why the hell does he care about it?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
He says that he was rightly stitched up. Now, whether or not Willian actually used the term stitched up remains to be seen. But he fumed on his Instagram account. I've been informed that a letter of authorization for player agent FIFA, allegedly signed in my name, has been circulated in the football market. So there's this letter that's gone out where... Denny Robson Diaz, Willian's current agent, he gave to Mr. Rene Pinheiro Anuchiachau the broadest consent by parties with the right on my behalf to request and represent in an exclusive manner to carry out my representation. This is the statement here. So basically, one agent falsely signing over the consent to Willian's rights to another agent. Whether or not that other agent exists remains to be seen. So this is obviously a bid from this guy, Anuchiachau, to actually become Willian's agent. Now, I'm not sure about you, but if you forge a letter, you can't suddenly act on behalf of that agent's player. You actually have to go and
is that not the way it works? I would have thought that you would just send in the letter and then Willian would go, oh, crap, well, sure, look, if that's the way it is, you're now my agent, let's crack on. Is
surprisingly,
that
like, granted, we don't know a lot about how modern football works. Mm. We don't know how it really works, but I'm going to stick my neck out here and suggest that is not the case, that Willian himself will probably have to go along with this new agent. I don't think he shows up and there's a strange man sitting in the room and he's like, I'm now your agent.
Are you the guy that sent the letter? Oh, I'm pleased to meet you. Look, it's come about quite unusually, but let's crack. How would he, like, the big thing is, the real head scratcher for me is, like, how would one procure the, because they've got Willian's signature clearly on the document. Like, it's real head scratcher for me as to how one would go about procuring the signature of a Premier League footballer. Well, you could put on this.
Yeah, I have no idea. There's definitely no opportunities online or on eBay to find a signature of a professional.
Or just to rock up to a ground and go, hey, Willian, sign this thing for me. Like, he could have actually signed that thing and not have had a clue about it.
They must have threatened him to, and coerced him to actually sign the thing. So, unfortunate story for Willian. And unfortunately, he'll probably be turfed out of Chelsea and get himself a lovely new move somewhere.
Or just get a pay rise at Chelsea.
I do feel sorry for the man.
Nearly half eight on this Friday morning, and we're going to talk hockey very shortly. We have a beautiful boxing mini-doc to come your way as well, so stay tuned for all of that good stuff. But in the meantime, it is a big weekend of the Super 8s. We've Donegal, Tyrone, Dublin, Roscommon, Kerry, Kildare and Galway, Monaghan, so all of that good stuff on the horizon this weekend. And to discuss it all, I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line by Mayo's Lee Keegan. Good morning to you, Lee.
How are you doing, guys? How are you?
Very good. Thanks a million for taking the call. First of all, before we get stuck into some of that analysis, we were wondering... a Lara Corbett documentary from a couple of years ago sprung to mind when I heard you were coming on, Lee, and I don't know if you remember this one, but Tipperary had been put out of the championship a bit earlier than they would normally have been, and he was part of this documentary sitting in an empty ground saying, I don't know what the hell to do with myself. This is not something that I normally have to do. What have you been up to?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest, I haven't been sitting in the dark corner any of the last 6 weeks or 5 weeks anyhow, so I definitely can confirm that. Honestly, I suppose after the initial loss of Galera, just, you know, had a couple of days to reflect, you know, kind of go for a few beers and catch up with the guys and maybe discuss what happened or what we could have done. And then after that, to be honest, I kind of got back to work and back to club training the following week and just try and keep my mind occupied, to be honest. So, if I'm honest, it's been a really hectic kind of 4 or 5 weeks between club. Socialising has definitely been a has gotten up 100% since we've been knocked out, and just kind of catching up with friends and family and bits and pieces like that. So it's been really hectic from that point of view. And Joe, because of all these interactions and bits and pieces, you know, it's been really good for my head alone. And John, I have seen Blair Corbett, and you know, I've always thought that as well. Maybe what would happen if we were to go out early, or what would I do, or how would I act? And to be honest, there's such a good, probably good people behind me that I haven't really had time to really, you know, sit down and say, well, the year's over between one bit and another, to be honest.
Were you on that Garth Brooks video?
I was with two or three others hiding in the background. I wouldn't be much of a singing man, so I tried to say it as much as possible.
Well, it turns out Aidan is not that much of a singing man either.
I have no comment. I let you decide that.
Just one point on just something you mentioned there, just about, you know, meeting up with the players and picking through what went wrong for the course of the season. Was that is that just a cathartic thing that you discuss it and you sort of get it out and it's helpful to move forward, or is there a more concrete sort of, well, if you would have just done that and I'd have just done that and we'd have sort of tweaked it out another way, is it which one of those is it?
No, I suppose what we did, we haven't really had a more formal meeting in terms of the year itself. And, you know, I think it was just more just a general chat over a beer, you know, and just in a different environment, and just saying, you know, we just kind of sat down together and just said, listen, you know, what we're wrong and how could we have done better, you know, that kind of generic talk that you have over a few drinks. So
yeah,
it's just one of those things where, you know, really and truly, like, when we look back and when I look back, is I don't really have a complaint, because if we were to lose that and we were the better team, maybe we could say, well, you know, tough on us. But to be really honest, you know, we came up with a team that were just maybe 2 or 3% more intensity than us. And if I'm being brutally honest, they probably did their game, actually, I did what we usually do to teams. They ran us really hard throughout the whole game. And to be honest, they could have won the game by 6 or 7 points in the end.
Just one other thing, Lee, before we move on to the weekend's football. I just wanted to ask you about your appearance on the Saturday game there at the start of the Super 8s. How did you find that first foray into punditry?
Interesting. I suppose it's new to me. Again, it's filling kind of a gap and a void. And, you know, watching some of the games that there is definitely different from my point of view. I suppose I have to brush up on some of my lingo with the likes of Joe and Tomas, who've been there quite a long time, and try and get my point across maybe. But, you know, I actually really enjoyed it, to be honest. I'd be a really enthusiastic GA fan outside of it, obviously, and I love going up to games and watching what teams do or how they implement systems and tactics and plays. So for me, I was only delighted to get on and watch from a different point of view for myself anyway, and try and take away a few points from the game.
What's been a tougher experience, marking Dermot Connolly or being a pundit alongside Joe Brawley?
Joe Brawley every day. Hands down, eh?
Don't brush up on the lingo too much, Lee. That's the...
No, I tell you, it's like going into a ring with a haymaker of a punch and he catches that once and you're hitting the ground. That's game over.
I'd say you wouldn't be shy about sort of...
No, with Dermot, hey, you're going 12 rounds. So.
Right, talk to us a bit about the football of the weekend. There's some interesting stuff and obviously things to be decided, even though, for example, we start with Galway and Monaghan, they're already into the semis, but we've just been discussing Dublin. Like, how much of a motivation and how much will it be spoken about, that idea of obviously they got to win to avoid the Dubs? It's a significant thing. Does that get spoken about much, do you think, this week, or how does that play out? How does it impact the game?
Yeah, I suppose I talk about this game a bit as well. It's a really tricky one due to the nature of, I suppose, the setup. Like, we obviously know Galway into the semi already, but I don't know. Going by Kevin Welch and the way he's kind of gone about the year, I don't really think they're worried about too much in the background. I do honestly believe they're going to go for this game full hold, or going hold, to be honest, because I think they see an opportunity to play another big team and to put down America again for the year. And to be honest, if the way they're going, the you know, people are criticising, you know, the way they're playing and bits and pieces, but to be honest, I don't think Kevin Welch is going to really care, to be honest, because he's in the semi-final already. He's got the luxury now of saying, do you know what, hey, we're going to take down another big team here at the weekend on our home patch. And Monaghan, I think, you know, for them as well, it's really interesting. I thought they were absolutely fantastic against Kerry. I think they're a really top team, to be honest, with some really top players. I think the biggest problem for them at the moment is they need one more man scoring than what Conor Madison scoring. I think their shooting kind of let them down in the latter stages when they had the game by the collar. So it's definitely going to be a really interesting one. If I'm to call it, and I really do think Monaghan are going to go for it hard. I do think they're going to pip them maybe by 1 or 2 points. But, you know, I think it's going to be a really intense, tough battle with a lot of, let's say, off-the-ball stuff that we're not going to see on camera.
Yeah, and we can see how well Galway have done from the table on screen there.
Yeah, of course. And listen, that's, I suppose Kevin is always, he's not shy about saying they had to up the stakes in terms of physicality over the last couple of years, the prior team beating us. And from our point of view, they've beaten us 3 years in a row, and that's something we've experienced firsthand between league and championship, that they've really upped the physical stakes. And do you know what? Hey, you can only commend them because they're winning games. I know it's not pretty at times, but if you're winning games like that, and be there by a couple of points, they are saying that, I suppose, to be a really top team, they're not getting rid of teams quicker. They're keeping the likes of Kildare in the game that time when they could have went further on and a man up as well. So that'll be a bit of a concern for Kevin if they come to that situation again. They really need to press harder and get more of the top players. And for me at the moment, I think we're talking with the likes of Shane Welsh and Damien Comer, but I think without Ian Burke at the moment, these guys are not going to be getting on half the water scores as they are. I just think he's like a little wizard or a little Messi in there and the top of the D, and his hands are just absolutely magnificent to watch. I tell you, he's one of the nicest players I've seen. Not nice, but one of the most skillful and influential players you see out there, and his unselfishness has been seen over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, like ultimately Mayo have got as close as anybody to this Galway team this summer. What was your plan against them?
I suppose our plan was we dropped a lot of numbers back to try, I suppose, negate their attack. We're very wary of what they have up front, and like for Shane Welsh and Damien Comer, and I suppose we got first hand in the league what they did do to us at times when we all kind of floated forward at numbers and what they could do on the counter attack. So it was really just trying to combat their counter and try and get a nice, not a slow build up, but try and pick pockets where we could. And we did that well at times. I suppose the send-off maybe had some form of influence in the first half. But if you look at the overall context game, we actually had a lot of chances. And when it came down to the team that had the one goal chance was Galway, and they buried it in Johnny Heaney. So like our plan was to, I suppose, get a turnover and a counter-attack as quick as possible, because they do sometimes commit numbers to their attack. And we did identify that, and we did start really well. But again, just I suppose when it came down to the last few minutes, our legs kind of ran out, and the injury to Tom Harrison, the send-off, I think that's had a bit of a brunt on the team towards the end.
Yeah, and even like Monaghan are a bit of an unknown quantity, obviously, as well. So we'll see. Big expectations that they haven't really fully met. So we'll see how that one pans out. That's Galway Monaghan in Salt Hill. We'll move on to Donegal Tyrone, Ali, just to Ballybuffet on Sunday. It's one of the more interesting games of the weekend. Donegal, obviously, with this long unbeaten run in Ballybuffet, 21 games, three of which have been against Tyrone. And a place in the semi-finals, obviously, up for grabs as the winner here as well. Where exactly do you see this Tyrone team at? They're another one that are sort of hard to get a bit of a fix on.
Yeah, I suppose if we look at the Tyrone Dublin game, it was a brilliant game for us to watch as neutrals and spectators. So I'd be expecting Tyrone to come out really hard. I'm sure they'll be well aware, as you mentioned, that they've gone up there three times in the last year and got beaten, so that'll be in the back of mind. And obviously there's a bigger prize for both teams within there if there's a semi-final, so that's going to add huge incentives now. I think there's a bit of talk coming out of Tyrone that Mike Dandy could be absent to the game at the weekend. And for me, if that's the case, I think the pendulum could swing just slightly towards Donegal because his influence in games is huge. Although I did think he struggled against Dublin. When he did likes against Dublin, they did their matchup so well. So I think for him not to be involved the weekend will be critical towards how Tyrone's game plan is going to set up. But yeah, just looking at Donegal, I was really impressed. Now, people say that Roscommon are struggling in the Super Race, but I was really impressed that Declan Bonner changed things up a small bit and put Michael Murphy in the edge of square where we all want to see him. I thought he was absolutely fantastic. Obviously, he's not going to get the same space or time against Tyrone, but from a neutral point of view, to see him up there doing what he does best was really good. And the likes of Ryan McHugh, I don't know if Owen Bongallers will be there or not, another huge player for them. I picked him up at the start of the year saying he's definitely he's looking at an all-star the way his year was going. So I think it's going to be, a really tight game. I think it'll be very nervy for the first 20, 25 minutes until hopefully we'll have a goal to kind of liven up. So for me, I do think maybe the Ballybuffet, the Maidenhead factor, I do think Donegal might have just a couple of inches or a couple of percent for the weekend. But it's a huge incentive for both teams, to be honest.
Yeah, you're right about Gallagher. It'll be interesting to see if he plays and the Ballybuffet factor, of course. But from a Tyrone point of view, you obviously, you beat them in the 2016 quarters. I don't remember, Lee, who scored the winning point that day. There was only a point between them. But they are difficult. They were picked apart, obviously, by Tyrone in the semi-finals last year, and everybody, Sean Kavanagh was out, and he was very critical about sort of plan A and only plan A, and plan A wasn't really working. Are you seeing something different in Tyrone this year? I mean, those injuries aside, that might point to the possibility of going a bit further this year.
Yeah, well, I suppose we've seen them people say that they're up in Omagh playing Dublin, that was a bit of a factor, but we all know the way Dublin play and the way they go about their game, so I don't know about that, but just looking at the way they're playing, they seem to be a bit more freer in their game plan now. I haven't seen a lot to suggest their plan has changed dramatically, to be honest. It's still very much based around running harder teams, looking for the likes of your Floodens, your Hart, these guys trying to lead the way in terms of scoring. So again, I suppose, and what I've been critical of them, like, I would have been very impressed with how they've gone in the two Super games, to be honest. They put up a huge score in Croke Park against Roscommon, really pushed Dublin hard up to the last 2 or 3 minutes. We all know how Dublin finished games. So I would be very positive in the way that they have been playing and how they're scoring, but I haven't seen a huge change. And like I said, you talk about a plan A. I still don't see a plan B if things go really belly up, in terms of if Tyrone get a big run or Donegal get a big run on them in the first 15, 20 minutes, how are they going to respond to that? Are they going to stick to the same game plan they have? Are they going to retreat numbers and run hard from there? So for me, I haven't seen a huge change, but I have seen a huge confidence change in the way they have been playing and the way they are, the way they're demanding the ball, the way they're responding to the team. So it's not a huge change in their game plan, but they do look a lot more confident, and they do look like they're ready to battle up in Ballybuffet at the weekend.
Yeah, you would suspect that the matchups, there'll be a lot of focus on that from both camps this week, because they like to do that in this clash. They like to do it in a lot of Ulster clashes where they pick a certain man and they like to target him. And ultimately, you wouldn't be surprised if it's a hot encounter on Sunday, where it's a testy affair, where there might be a bit of a psychological battle going on. And I do wonder how big a factor that is in intercounty football at the moment, where teams are just basically trying to wind each other up.
Yeah, yeah. But like, that was, I suppose, Tyrone kind of got like Tyrone against Dublin to a degree, because you're talking about Tyrone, you know, been very proud of their matchups and, you know, trying to get the best players. If you look at the Doma game, Dublin got their matchups 100% right. Like, took out Peter Hart, they took out Sludden, took out Mike Donnelly, three of their key players, Tyrone, and that very the heartbeat. So it is going to be really interesting to see how they do shape up against Donegal. Now, in terms of matchups, I think it's going to be difficult. Obviously, they're going to be targeting Murphy and Ed Squirby's there. But like, in terms of matchups, there probably won't be a lot, because, again, when we look at the likes of these games, it's very much, I suppose, defensive focus. So you'll have a lot of counter-attacking with players picking up maybe a different guy that he's marking at the start, or a different guy. So you'd be just picking up lads that they're running past. So I think it's going to be a really feisty and bitey affair. I think Donegal will bring a huge physicality to Ballybuffet. We've seen that over the years, and they've really intimidated teams from the start, from the throw-in. So That's going to be a key factor, how that throw-in goes and who gets the first score. And that's going to set the tone early. And I'll be honest, I think the referee is going to really have to stamp his authority early in the game if you know, he doesn't want that thing spiral out of control early, because we know how that goes, and especially in Ulster affairs, that things can go over the edge quite quickly if it's let. And I think the referee is going to have a huge job at the weekend.
Just before we wrap, I mean, I think nobody's really expecting any great surprises at Croke Park between Dublin and Roscommon. Dublin already through, of course, with a game to spare there. And I actually don't know really what even constitutes a surprise in the Kerry-Kildare game. Lee, what are you thinking?
Obviously, the Roscommon-Dublin game, maybe just a word, like, say that, you know, people have criticised Roscommon hugely in the Super 8, but I suppose if you look at it through the year, they've got promoted, they got to Connacht Final and Challenge Galway, they made the Super 8. So I'd be less critical of Roscommon, to be honest. Now, I still think they're a long way off maybe the top eight teams. And now people can say we didn't make it ourselves, and that's the case. But we've been challenged for years, so I think it'd be a bit unfair. But for Roscommon, I think this is a huge learning lesson for them to go forward the next couple of years. They are probably 5-6 players short of competing against some of the top teams. But for Kevin McStay, I think it's been a huge learning curve. And going to Croke Park the weekend and just say, you know what, just throw off the shackles. If we get beaten by 20 or 10, whatever it is, at least we try to play the game in the right manner, in the right way. So I think it's an opportunity for them. A low confidence could be at a huge low. And then the Kerry-Kildare game, I suppose we've had Kildare firsthand. So they've been quite unlucky, to be honest, in the Super 8. I thought they performed very well in the first two games. Again, just probably didn't have that clinical edge in the two games. When they're in the game, to be honest, they could have put the foot on a bit more and went harder teams like they did against us. So I do think Kerry are going to be maybe 5, 6, 7 points better at the weekend, but they're very much dependent on how the Monaghan game goes. That it's going to be a really interesting weekend from that point of view. So listen, I'm hoping for a great weekend of football. I suppose after the hurling weekend last week, it's probably going to be hard to top the quality, the excitement and the tension and all that. But you know, football has reduced it for years and years on end, so I can't see why, you know, we're letting the hurling dictate so much this year. I know it deserves pundits and applause and all that, because it has been spectacular, but you know, I think this is the weekend that hopefully really fires up the football and gets everyone talking about it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Just one last one for me, Lee, then. It's like, obviously that result in Killarney could be completely futile depending on what happens in Salt Hill on tomorrow evening. Like, when you were facing Kerry last year in that All-Ireland semi-final replay, were you surprised by how they altered in the second match and how they kind of went completely defensive and in a defensive system that essentially shot themselves in the foot? And you walked home then in the end. You were by far the better team then in the end in the second match. And it does seem that when you kind of analyse games where Kerry have been in the melting pot this year, the likes of the Galway game in particular, that there has been a failure of systems. I'm not sure, would you agree with that, having seen it up close last year and how much they've come on this year?
More from a defensive point of view as well, I think they're very, they look very uncertain of how to mark a forward or a top forward. Like, as we could all see, and you know, Conor Gwanis had 1-1 after like 4 minutes against Kerry, and Fitzmaurice was very nervy to change it for so long because I don't think he was he could rely on anyone else maybe to do it. Or for me, like, Paul Murphy would be their best back. I would have him as the man marker, to be honest, because I've got to, I suppose, mark him first hand or play against him first hand. I would see him as one of the really top players in the country. But yeah, there just seems to be, like, for me, when, as you mentioned, that whole wholesale changes, like, from, say, the Galway game to the Monaghan game, I just find that a bit dramatic. And maybe, you know, things are not as smooth as they were from Munster to the Super 8. And maybe that's a sign that they're just not as confident and taken. And I'd be more kind of inclined to look at their forward line, to be honest. I looked at Paul Gini the weekend. I thought he looked very off par. Maybe he's carrying an injury. You know, he had 3 shots in the first 10 minutes and he converted on them. James O'Donnell came on, didn't get a score, maybe had 1 shot. You know, they relied on Donny to get 1 flick to keep them in the game. Now, they're lucky that they've Clifford at the moment because he has really stepped up to plate and kept Kerry in the championship, to be brutally honest with you. He was, in his 2 games so far, he's hit 2-7, I think, and, you know, all from play. So I think he's been absolutely fantastic for Kerry, and he's really stepped up to senior, like, at a breeze, at an ease, to be brutally honest. So I think the young guys are really setting up for Kerry. I think just need some of the old rear guard now to really, you know, go out Kildare at the weekend. I still think they're going to win, to be honest, but if they do get the result, I don't know how much more they can offer in the semi-final, like ourselves last year. You know, when we played them in the replay, we couldn't get over how much space and time they afforded us, and they just gave us so much time to press them so hard for the full game that, as I said, we actually ran out quite easy winners. And then, so it will be interesting to see if they do get through, but, you know, I don't know. I think it's going to be very tough for them, to be honest.
Yeah, interesting stuff, all right, and we look forward to the weekend. Listen, we don't want to let you off, Lee, before asking. It is that time of the year that you get the sort of general turnaround of managers and management team, and Mayo haven't been any different than that this year with some of the backroom staff announcing that they're departing this week. Tony Buckley's gone and Peter Burke is gone, and it seems like Tony McEntee might go, all of which suggests that Stephen Rochford is going to stay on. I know he does have another, he's contracted in so much as that is a thing for another year. What's your thought on that? I mean, I think you've been there 6 or 7 years, obviously maybe 3 different management teams. In terms of that consistency, is it good timing for Mayo that there's a bit of a turnaround at this stage?
Honestly, I don't, it's hard to know, to be honest. Change is a good thing sometimes, but I suppose, from Stephen's point of view, to lose probably 3 of the guys that have been with us very well over the last 3 years and really developed us and pushed us to the brink of All-Ireland, you know, that's tough to see. And them guys, you know, they owe us nothing in terms of, they don't need to justify why they left. You know, they have their family lives, their travel lives, their work lives, bits and pieces. So, like, we owe them hugely for what they've done with us. So I think the biggest thing for us probably is, where do you go to look for people, to be honest? Like, there isn't a huge pick out there at the moment because a lot of the top guys are already with teams or they're busy with other sports or whatever. So I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for us, is to try and get a backroom team together. And, you know, obviously Stephen's well aware of that, and Stephen's smart enough to know that, you know, he's going to have to look hard and look somewhere for these people now. Obviously, Mayo have been one of the top teams. I think it is quite appealing, and there should be good interest because, again, we have a lot of top players, and, you know, we should be very confident next year of, you know, coming back in January and putting in a huge year again. So, you know, from the player point of view, we're not worried about that, but it's who do you look to, where do you go to find it? You know, it's not that easy to say, right, we've lost 3 of our best guys in terms of backroom. How do you replace them 3 guys, or where do you replace them? So that'll be Stephen's biggest challenge now over the next couple of weeks. You know, again, from a player point of view, we're just waiting for, I suppose, notification and make sure he's been ratified again. So I can't really be saying too much about that because I don't know myself, to be brutally honest. So again, we're very interested to hear what's going to happen, but I suppose from a player point of view at this time, it's very much just club focused. So when we get a call to meet up maybe and discuss with the team where we're going and what we're going to be after next, maybe from the winter onwards, then we'll get a good idea of what we're looking at for the year ahead. But the 3 guys leave, yeah, I'll be honest now, I would have had a very good relationship with 3 of them, three different types of guys now in terms of how to look at the game and how to approach the game. So yeah, so it's sad times because we lost to Kildare, but it was sad to see some of the main guys go like that. And yeah, so far the players are sticking tight, and, you know, they're just going about their business, enjoying a bit of downtime. And again, once the call comes around again, we meet up, I'm sure that'll get the blood book going again. So
Yeah, absolutely, no doubt. If there were any good club managers knocking around Westport, you could have some sort of like a super management team.
We're keeping him for another while.
Lee, thanks a million. Enjoy the games this weekend.
Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Lee Keegan there, looking ahead to the Super 8 games this weekend. What do you think about that idea? It suddenly struck me there that a James Horan, Stephen Rochford, super management team. I mean, joint managers has always worked out in Mayo, so...
Yeah, whether or not two people who've had the helm for themselves would add up to the sum of their parts very much remain to be seen, I would think.
If they could be sold the dream that this is going to put Mayo as close as possible to sort of reaching out and touching the void.
It's such a weird situation that they're in. What more can they do? Mm. When you look at last year, what more can they do?
Sack the manager. That's like, I mean, I'm not saying that's what they should do. I'm saying that's what generally tends to happen. When they look around and go, what more could we do? Where can we find these inches? Generally, it tends to be, you go now. We'll get somebody else in.
Like, you've got to look at the last two All-Ireland finals as two of the best losing performances we've ever seen. Yeah. Like, the replay or the first game, it's hard to say in 2016, but certainly last year was one of the best losing performances we've ever seen. It's very hard to realise how you get back to that. Maybe it's, you know, focus more on Connacht. If they had Lee playing against Galway and Castlebar and made it 13th this summer, mm-hmm. they might have beaten them, and we might be talking about them up against Monaghan this weekend. You wouldn't know. So it could have been a very different situation. The margins are so bloody tight in this game that, you know, I'm like, it doesn't take me to tell Mayo people how tight those margins are, given all the pain they've gone through over the last decade.
Mm. The under 20 final, obviously, I mean, in terms of where Mayo can go differently from here, they're obviously contesting the under 20 final at the weekend against Kildare at Croke Park. Lee Keegan, actually, 6 club mates involved in that game. So, I mean, it also means that James Horan is working with those players and Stephen Rochford gives it a bash for another year. And suddenly there's a new impetus of the old guy coming back in and bringing a bunch of these players with him. And
well, maybe James Horan becomes Mayo hurling manager and steals all those great players and turns them into hurlers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we should see. I mean, because it works out for every county that where you've got impetus and new players that come in at the start of the season and they have a really positive impact on the team and you know, things develop along to the point where you've been spoken about as All-Ireland contenders on.
What are you talking about?
Kerry.
Are you saying they're All-Ireland contenders?
No.
Why not?
I'm saying that they've...
You're saying they're not All-Ireland contenders.
Exactly. I'm saying that I tipped them for the All-Ireland at the start of the year on the basis of all the young players that were coming through and the old guard that were there and it was a good match. It just hasn't... I don't think anybody's tipping them for All-Ireland success at this stage.
You're categorically ruling them out.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I'm looking forward to playing that clip very, very shortly.
Off the Ball is Cork bound on Saturday. It's a very special show that we're bringing your way. We want you to join us for a special Saturday panel. It includes living legends Rena Buckley and Sonia O'Sullivan. Off the Ball broadcasting the Saturday panel ahead of the Camogie quarterfinals at Páirc Uí Chaoimh at the newly refurbished iconic Cork Stadium. Sonia, Rena, Kieran McCarthy, the journalist, and Christina Donovan, who's the Deputy Director of Sport at UCC, are going to join our own Cliona Foley to discuss the stories from the week. So it's a very special show. It's in advance of the Camogie Quarters, and it's at Páirc Uí Chaoimh. And tickets, a small number of tickets, are still available, so you can just head along to offtheball.com and get yourself a couple of those sweet tickets for that. It's going to be a bloody good show.
Just on the, sorry, just to come back to the young players' point. Like, what right-minded person thinks others a batch of new young players coming into the squad, therefore they're going to win the All-Ireland this year? Like, well, what's the... Whenever has that had that instant impact? Are you not putting your money on 2020 or something? No,
like, it was a case of... Look, Lee Keegan obviously, like, I mean, you just heard him speak about what Mayo did to them in the replay last year and how they were a bit astonished by the room they were given. So that points to, like, you listen to that and you hear, well, there's no way they could have won the All-Ireland this year if that's what's happening. But
well, that also suggests a humongous underachievement.
But there were, so my point is that there were a team that were thereabouts, right? Could have won,
yes,
could have won the first day, could have
exactly
given an All-Ireland final. So at that point, they're absolutely All-Ireland contenders, right? So they're thereabouts. They've got a couple of two, maybe three young players that have come through that have been spoken about in unbelievable terms, even in a Kerry context. So that's the little, grain of sand, the grain of rice, to borrow the Kerry vernacular.
And what did you make, of their performances last Sunday week?
I was on holidays and I didn't see it.
Well, they were their best players, I'll tell you that. There was four youngsters who stood up and they were their best players. So,
I saw some of it. And also one of the old guard who creates the goal at the end.
Everybody in the prime of their career didn't show up. So Like, obviously it's not in their hands, but anyway, I'm getting down a wormhole of emotion here.
we love you for it, Owen. OTBAM is live with Screwfix.ie, championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products. Now, it is time to turn to boxing. Last week, Andy Lee sat down with Seamus McDonough. He's an Irish boxer with a pretty incredible story. In 1990, when Buster Douglas beat Mike Tyson and derailed a Tyson-Holyfield mega fight, McDonough was drafted in to be Evander Holyfield's next opponent. Outside of the ring, he battled with alcoholism and he lived with a brain injury long after his boxing career. He eventually became a successful director and actor. Enjoy it.
Just to go back, how did you get into boxing?
My father was a fighter in London. Reluctantly, I did what the outlet said. Mm.
Did you feel he forced you to box? Do you think you would have boxed if he didn't push you or influence you to box?
Never would have fought.
Really?
No. I mean, I might have tried it.
Did you feel like you had a natural instinct for it, or was something that you had to really work on?
My brother John, who actually won more amateur acclaim than I did, he was a better boxer than me, tougher. He was smaller than me, so he's a tougher man than me. So he was a great fighter, and I don't think he really liked it that much either. But he was more naturally, it came more natural to him. Me, I hated it when I was a kid. I guess I'm also a recovered alcoholic. So for some reason, as alcoholics, we are very sensitive, you know. And the people ask you, why'd you quit fighting? I said, I became allergic to getting hit in the head, you know. but we did it, you know, because you know choice, like, really, you know.
For a person, for a fella who didn't like the sport, to go as far as you did, to eventually end up fighting Evander Holyfield, how does that happen?
It's a long story. I'll give you a brief synopsis of it. I ended up fighting with a Mayo team against a Chicago team in Chicago back in the 80s. And my father came over with me. So then I came back and he stayed there. And then he eventually moved to New York. And so in the early 80s, my sister Rosalind and I moved to New York. And I came from Enfield to Brooklyn, so it was quite a change, quite a shock. And it was great in the beginning, and then I got a job driving the horse and carriages around the park in Manhattan, and which was a great job and making a rake of money. And I was drinking a lot then, you know. I was only young, you know.
How old would you have been?
When I started the horse and carriages, I was about 20, yeah. And by the time I was 21, almost 22, I found myself drinking way too much and drove in a blackout and woke up one morning with a scar halfway on the sidewalk, halfway on the street, thinking, "What? I'm 21, what am I doing? I'm ruining my life, I can't stop drinking." So I swore off drinking.
Were you also boxing alongside all this?
I had been in the Golden Gloves 2 years before that. Mm. I lost in the quarterfinals, usually to the eventual winner actually both times, and it was a very close fight too. Well, you know, I'm a real boxer. We never get beat. No one can ever beat us. You know, we're always robbed. So that year, I started training on January 4th for the Golden Gloves, and they start February. So February 1st was my first fight.
Not a lot of time.
No, yeah. But back then you're young. I was 20, 21, or maybe 22 at the time. 22. But the previous years, I had 11 fights over the 3 years in the Golden Gloves. I never got a decision because I was always with the wrong club. That's political stuff. So I started fighting, and I knocked all the guys out in 85 to win the title, you know, win the heavyweight title. I was really only a cruiserweight because I only weighed 190. Mm. But I forget your question, Andy.
How did you lead up? So you've won the Golden Gloves.
Yes.
You work your way up to be a contender.
Yeah.
In the cruiserweight division.
I was really a cruiserweight,
yeah. You were ranked number 3 in the world at one stage.
Yeah,
And then you move up to heavyweight.
Well, what happened was I took a fight against a guy named Cecil Coffey. I had a very good record. I think he was 19-2 with 18 knockouts. And initially when I saw the record, I said, gee, why am I fighting this guy, you know? So I looked at the tape and said, I can beat that fella, you know? And it was a tough fight. Won that fight well. But a great, very exciting fight. And I fought a guy named Michael Greer. He was world-ranked also. And then they, all of a sudden, they had me ranked number 9 in the world as a heavyweight, but 3 as a cruiserweight. So in February or so of 1990, the biggest shock in boxing history, the invincible Mike Tyson gets knocked out by Buster Douglas. So threw the whole boxing world on its head because the biggest fight of the year of the century was supposed to be, or any of the decade, was supposed to be Holyfield against Tyson. So I guess they looked in the rankings. They saw they had a huge following on the East Coast of America. So they asked me to fight Holyfield. And we said, I'm not going to fight Holyfield. I'm a cruiserweight. He's the number one in the world heavyweight. And then they came back a week later and they says, okay, but if you beat him, you'll make $25 million in your next fight. So we had to take it, you know.
Would that have potentially been against Tyson?
No, because Buster Douglas was the champion.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. See, then I actually did. I didn't do great against Holyfield, but I got him a few slaps.
And time is the night Douglas beat Tyson. A night which ended up having huge implications for you in your life.
Yes.
Where were you that night?
I was actually watching it in Staten Island at the Buchanan's, which is behind my girlfriend's house, the Rossi. She was Rossi. In February of 1990, yeah.
No idea that this was going to play
none.
All out and you were going to play a role in this.
Exactly, yeah. So we had the fight was set up and we didn't have really enough time to get ready, but it was fine, I was in good shape. But mentally I wasn't prepared at all, you know, and all that attention. I mean, I was talking to Trump, and I was talking to, not that I wanted to talk to him, but I was talking to all these people and all these interviews and all these phone calls. It's like, you know what it's like, Andy, the barrage of
what did Trump say to you?
He actually came into the dressing room after the fight, and he says, you put up a great fight. He says, we want you to fight here again, because a lot of people came down to see me, you know?
Yeah.
So
it was a great fight. In terms of, well, Holyfield, you could see, without being disrespectful, was maybe a class above or had more potential to go further at that stage. But for periods in the rounds, you were definitely in the fight. And the exchange, the final exchange, it was a real trade-up. Like, you could have been an inch either way of either of you going down.
Yeah. Would you believe I've thought about that for the last 25 years ago, 27 years ago, 28 years ago, Jeannie Mike. I've thought about that fight probably almost every day for the last 28 years, you know? It never leaves us.
How does it sit with you now?
Well, of course, I always kind of wish it was different, you know, and I wish I'd just calmed down a bit and not try to knock out the number one heavyweight in the world. I wish I just relaxed more and take it easy and just moved around, not try to knock him out, which was a bit of an insane, you know. But
I've read that you spoke about when you stepped in during the first round that you felt fear. Do you think the way you fought was a reaction to that fear, or
possibly because mentally I wasn't prepared for that fight.
How so?
Well, I didn't even have a mental practice, you know. I mean, now I'm 22 years sober, and that's been the biggest fight of my life. You know, I've been staying sober, but it's not even a fight. Staying sober is trying to control the thoughts in the brain, which I've been shown how to do with the 12 steps, which I wish I had back then, because they eradicate all the fear, and you're in reality. And when you're in reality, there's nothing to fear, you know. So I became completely overwhelmed. When the bell went, I could barely even walk. You know, I was like, oh my God, you know. And I found out now that I was actually blocking all the nerves out for days before and weeks before, blocking them out, trying to shut it all off, all the noise in your head. And when the bell went, it all hit me. You know what that's like.
I know.
If you're not dealing with it, it's going to be there. So when the bell went, it all hit me. And you're in the ring with the number one heavyweight in the world, you know. It's not the best time to start losing it, you know. So I...
But you fought him. You did fight him. You weren't just in there, you know. You weren't making up the numbers.
Exactly. I tried to.
He knew you were there.
He did. Because we've in the boxing world, you know, all these people, and he's very respectful of me, you know. And I've seen him quite a few times since, and I actually showed him the picture of I got him a great shot in the fourth round. I showed him the picture.
Right hand that we've seen in the preliminaries and now in the semifinals. It's something that, I don't know, seemed to come all of a sudden. Did you have it? You must have had it, but how did you develop it this well?
I've always had a pretty good punch, and
it's a good hairdo,
huh?
Out
on the back.
It changed a little bit as well.
On the right, quick right after the left.
What's your big dream, Seamus?
Well, in boxing, I'd like to be world champion. I guess boxers and everything, you know, in life I'd like to maybe do something with the troubles in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, try and stop all the killing and violence.
Yeah.
Hopefully united Ireland, but, you know, we've got to try and get peace there.
Yeah.
But in boxing, I'd like to be world champion.
Yeah. Well, you're going to St. John's now?
Yeah, I'm going to St. John's.
What are you studying?
Well, I'm studying liberal arts.
Uh-huh.
I'd like to go into law, maybe. You know, I'm undecided at the moment.
Uh-huh.
But, I'm, you know, enjoying it over there. A lot of nice guys over there.
I've watched your career, you know, right from the start, from the kid gloves on up. You have the desire to be a boxer, don't you? Really want to be a boxer?
Yeah, you got. It's probably the hardest of all sports. Uh-huh. You got to be.
How do you feel watching this?
It's kind of a, you know, I don't know. I just in shock, really, a little bit, huh?
How so?
Well, back then, you're so innocent, and you don't know what's going on, you know, and it can, you know, there's a lot, as you know, like getting into professional sports, professional boxing especially, it's so, I have to say, just so corrupt, you know. Mm. I wasn't affected that much. I mean, I didn't make a whole lot of money out of it. I'm so grateful to come out with not too much damage.
You spoke about maybe wanting to be a lawyer and studying, you know, literature and fine arts in college. And
yes.
I think you even mentioned about brokering a peace deal here when the Northern Ireland troubles. But do you have any regrets that you didn't follow those things, that you stuck to boxing? And, like, looking back, how do you feel about it? Do you think you could have took it? How your life would have been different had you taken a different course?
Of course, I've thought about that often, and I actually don't regret a thing. You know, I do have to say that you know, I fought for 18 years. I mean, if you're not fighting all the time, but you're sparring a lot, you know, especially in the pros, and you do get memory loss. You know, in my last fight, I got badly beaten. I got a headbutt in the second round. I fought in a blackout for 7 or 8 rounds. I wasn't even aware that the fight was going on. I wasn't conscious. So I got battered for that. I got a TBI, a traumatic brain injury in that fight. And it affected me for years. Still affects me somewhat, you know. So, I've forgotten the question again.
No regrets.
Not really, no. I mean... of course, I wish I'd made more money, but that's. I know a lot of very wealthy people, and money doesn't fix anybody either, you know. But I have to say that I'm like happy, you know what I mean? Yeah. And people kind of would ask me like, "What do you do?" You know, and all I can say really is that for the last 22 years I've been sober, and some lad in San Francisco showed me how to. Because everyone has problems, you know, and this is not a therapy course here or anything, you know, but everyone has problems. But how to deal with the problems. Mm. And I do a writing and meditation practice. I've done it every morning for 22 and a half years. I did it this morning. Mm. And it helps your brain, which is not trained to deal with this world, you know. It helps you deal with all your problems. And then you're, you know. when you're free of problems, you can be creative and try things you want to do and do anything you want, really.
You don't have to, but can you reveal to us what you write down? Is there like a mantra, or is it personal?
No, I can reveal. It's probably never been revealed before on TV, but we'll see. The meditation, I do a meditation called Transcendental Meditation. Works for some people and doesn't work for others, you know. But it worked for me, and it was a great. It's amazing. So before that, I write down basically my resentments. So when I don't get what I want, I get resentful, like a kid. We're all like big kids, actually, running around, you know. Some more than others, you know. So when I drank, all my fears were anesthetized, and it felt great. That's why people drink, because it anesthetizes their fears. But if you write down your fear, say, I have fear. Like before the morning, before this interview, I had fear I won't be able to find the gym, Carl Grady's gym. And then I have fear, I always have fear I'll crash the car. I'll get on the plane, I fear the plane will crash. Because I have negative thinking, you know. It's kind of like the alcoholic way, you know, we always have negative thinking. And they're not real. Mm. But if you write them down, they start to dissipate and they don't bother you as much. So I write them all down. But I write down the resentments first. When I want to get resentful. I used to always be resentful at my dad because the great guy, you know, he had 8 kids. He had a tough life. His father went to America when he was very young and was away. And when there was 5 kids and his mother passed away, had a heart attack in the kitchen, just like Dancing at Lunasa, that movie, kind of like the same thing. And they were left without a mother or a father for a long time, and his father came back and brought him to England and as a young fella, and so he had a rough life, you know. And you cannot pass on what you haven't got. So he had a rough life. So his thing was boxing, you know. And so I'd be resentful at my dad. So I'd be resentful at my dad because I fear he made me box. But the most important thing is to find out what the fears are, you know. Write them down, and then I'd write down, as I said before, the fears with no resentment attached. Like, I'd write down, I fear I'll run out of money. I fear I'll be late for the interview with Andy Lee. It's all this stuff, you know. So you empty your brain out, and you keep writing, and you think, when you start doing it first, I'll never stop. But if you keep doing it, then you say, just write them all down, and then I close my eyes and I meditate. And the feeling is as good as drinking when drinking was at its best. And that, I'm not going to lie about that.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. Life after boxing.
Life after boxing was hell.
Yeah.
There's actually a phenomenon, it's not a phenomenon to me anymore, in the medical books in America, and probably over here too, called PAS, Professional Athlete Syndrome. It applies to also like people who are, even if you have a job, you know, when you retire. When you retire from boxing, I mean, I retired at 28, you know. Most people retire in the 30s or so from boxing or from sports. When you used to, my whole life was boxing in the end. So when it was gone, it's like your best friend or your best, and whatever you want to call it, died. So how do you deal with that? That's why a lot of fighters end up broke, you know, drinking, you know, drugs, whatever they do, you know, crime even, you know. Because how do you replace that obsession? Because everyone in the world has the same obsession, which is to feel good. Mm. That's everyone's obsession. So it's why we work out, that's why we eat, drink. Everyone wants to feel good. Alcohol cut right to the goal of feeling good right away. So I digress as usual.
It's great.
Yeah.
How did you get into acting?
This is a funny story. I was drinking a bit in New York, and a car got towed. A car was towed about 10 times in New York, and the next day I had to go looking for the car, and I was over. the place where they keep the cars, they bring them to, is over on the west side of Manhattan near 34th Street. So I go over there and I go in and I get the car. And they say, oh, you owe a few tickets. I said, how many? He says, about $1,500. And that was 20 years ago, you know, more. And 25 years ago. So I said, I don't have $1,500 of you right now. So I walked out of the place and I walked to 34th and 11th. And that's Hell's Kitchen in New York. Right near the stables. I used to drive the horse and carriage around the park, and our stables is right there. So I'm going to go walk by the stables, see who was over there, because I know some people, know some friends over there. And I'm standing on the corner, 34th and 11th, and waiting for the light to change. And this, I hear this Dublin accent goes, Seamus McDonough! I'm like, who is this fella? And I look over, and some fella sitting in a car, an old car, and I say, hey. I didn't even ask him anything. I said, are you going uptown? He says, yeah. I jump in the car with him, total stranger. And it turned out to be Jimmy Smallhorn, the actor from, you know, from Love, Hate, and what's the movie that John Connors did?
Cowboy Gangsters.
Cardboard Gangsters, yes. Yeah. He says, I just got the lead in a play at the Irish Arts Centre. And I, being the grandiose, you know, person I was, I says, have they finished auditions? He says, no. So I went down the next day and I auditioned for Nye Heron, who's the assistant director on My Left Foot and all those movies with Jim Sheridan. And I auditioned and I gave me the part right away, and I started loving acting. And didn't do a whole lot of acting after that, but it kind of took off a few years ago, about 10 years ago, when I got an email from a guy in New York. He's a writer for Newsday, a sports writer, Bobby Cassidy Jr. And he says, this is the email said. He says, Seamus, hope you're well. He says, I wrote a play about my dad. My dad's supposed to play the lead. He can't do it. He's getting too old. Can you play the lead? We open in a month. I was like, okay, you know.
To the point.
Yeah, I says, can you send me the play before I say yes? He sent me the play, and I read it. The first time I read it, I cried, you know. And we've done that about 5 or 6 times, and that's led to other things. And so,
any plans to bring that to Ireland?
We'd love to bring it to Ireland. You know, the big problem is that we have about 5 world champions in the cast. Mm. You know, and it's a great play. We'd love to bring it over here. We have Michael Bent, former world heavyweight champion. Mm. Mark Breland's in it. Junior Jones is in it. Was in it, and he's not anymore. John Duddy's in it. And actually, we were doing it a few years ago, and Jimmy Smallhorn, I got him to be the director. And I played the lead, Kid Shamrock, the older and younger version, but grey stuff in my hair for the older version. And we're doing it one time, and I said to Bobby Cassidy, the writer, I says, it's too much work for me to do, you know, younger and older. I says, can we get someone else to do the younger? And they said, yeah. I said, who do you think we should get? I said, can I get you John Duddy? I'll ask John Duddy. So they said, okay. So I called John, and John was about to fight you. And he leaves another story here. and he had decided not to have the fight. He's finished with boxing. So I said, John, we're doing this play. There's a part I think you'd be great at. Would you be interested in doing it? He says, yes, right away. And he was down that day to start doing rehearsals. Yeah. So John's been acting ever since. And this is a funny story. I have to believe this. After the fight, my friend Fred Skippy, I went to school with, his dad, Fred Presapia, lived in Staten Island. So we went over there to see him after the fight. And he says, Seamus, you're in Sports Illustrated. I said, great. I says, where? So you show me, and there's a picture of me laying down and Holyfield standing up. And I said, just turn the picture around, and I'm standing up and he's laying down.
That was pretty good. That was Seamus McDonough in conversation with Andy Lee. It was produced and shot by Joe Conroy. That's my bad on.
For God's sake, Adrian.
Turn my mic off. I've now turned it back on again so you can hear me.
Sometimes sound is important for shows like this.
Yeah. That was a pretty good watch. It was Seamus McDonough in conversation with Andy Lee. You can check it out if you just caught the end of it or you want to rewatch it. Share it with your mates. Subscribe to the channel because then we'll tell you when all of that good stuff is coming up. It's youtube.com/offtheball and it's a pretty bloody good watch. It was, because you couldn't hear me the first time, it was Seamus McDonough in conversation with Andy Lee, and it was shot and produced by Joe Conroy. So it was a pretty exceptional watch. Hope you enjoyed it. That's really it from us for this morning. On we've had to cull various aspects of the show because I'm blaming the producer. It was Tommy's fault.
Always blame the producer. It's always the best thing to do.
Lots of good stuff coming your way over the weekend. We have a very special off the ball broadcast from Porky Cueve tomorrow. It's ahead of the Camogie quarterfinals. It'll be Cliona Foley with a Saturday panel on the road. And as I said, it's in association with the Camogie Association. And we have some Cork legends there, two of whom might be on the Cork Mount Rushmore potentially. Irina Buckley and Sonia O'Sullivan. And we're also going to be joined by the journalist Kieran McCarthy and Deputy Director of Sport at UCC, Christina Donovan. And that all kicks off tomorrow afternoon. You can get tickets for it if you head along to offtheball.com. And particularly if you're heading along to the Camogie afterwards, it makes for a pretty decent afternoon. So that's coming your way tomorrow.
Getting into Cork's Mount Rushmore is just a Pandora's box of...
It is a little bit, yeah.
Pain, really, like...
You see, I think what people forget is that Cork's Mount Rushmore would not just be four people because it's Cork.
But that's the point of Mount Rushmore.
Well,
there is only four.
I know, but it's, what I'm saying is it's Cork's Mount Rushmore and it's Cork and...
But the point of Mount Rushmore
is the People's
is
Republic
people.
Of Cork do things their own way. It'd probably be about 10 people. It'd be
but
bigger,
then it's not, then it's
it'd
not
be
Mount
bigger and better and smarter and more beautiful than any other Mount Rushmore you've ever seen.
But like, then it's not Mount Rushmore.
It'd be a tremendous Mount Rushmore.
But then you're missing the point of Mount Rushmore. It's four heads, top four. It's
I'm
your
just
power.
Saying,
it's not even
it's
power.
Cork. They do whatever
then
they want to do.
It's not called Mount Rushmore. Then it's called something else.
No, it's called whatever the Irish.
Can't call it Mount
it's
Rushmore.
Whatever
it's
the Irish
four heads.
For Mount Rushmore is, that's what it is. It'd be tremendous, beautiful, most amazing Mount Rushmore you've ever seen.
I don't know why I'm getting annoyed with this, but it's such a failure of understanding with Mount Rushmore.
Speaking about getting annoyed about things, you're off to Killarney tomorrow afternoon to see Kildare and. Kerry, what represents a surprise in this game? I'll repeat the question that I asked Lee.
Claire beating Kerry. Obviously, like I would suspect Kerry are going to look after their own business. I'll be standing on the terrace in Killarney, watching Monaghan versus Galway. Let's just put it that way. That's what I expect to happen in the second half, where hopefully Kerry will have a cushion where it's just listening to whatever is happening in Salt Hill. It's such a weird scenario to be in for Championship.
Yeah,
where like your own game could be completely pointless in the end.
Well, coming from Kerry, from Westmeath, mostly pretty pointless. So, if you need any advice about how to deal with any of that stuff, just holler.
Please, yeah, no, like I'm hollering now.
Resignation at some point in the game, embrace it. Don't get too invested in it because you're going to be disappointed.
Bit late for that. Like well over two decades of investment gone into this.
Yeah, I know, yeah. I'm just saying if you're looking for advice about how to deal with sporting disappointment. That's how to do it.
I've had to deal with plenty, don't worry about that.
The Westmeath game a couple of years ago that Westmeath were 8 or 10 points down, whatever it was at half time. I'd absolutely made my peace with the idea that this game was done. We're probably going to leave a bit earlier. Absolutely resigned to it.
Never,
that's fine.
I can't believe you were going to leave early.
That's what happens. I mean, yeah.
Why, like, never leave early from any sporting event. You've got to see it through to the bitter end.
No, I'd be with you. No, to be fair, I'd be with you.
Even if it turns into a 20-point hammering, you've got to be there till the very end.
I was there until the end. I'm going to use this reference to the end of my days to back up that I endorse your point. I stayed until the end of the Denmark game.
Yeah, a lot of people did.
So, well, Bruce Shields was sitting behind me and all I'm saying was he wasn't there at the end.
That's right. I did not know he was sitting behind you.
I mean, not a widely known fact.
You were in the prawn cocktail. Or
I
prawn
was not
sandwich,
in any either prawn cocktails
scenario.
Or prawn sandwiches.
But you were in the you were in a good seat.
No, I wasn't. No, I was in Joe Punter seats.
Why did you do that? You were literally presenting a corporate event beforehand.
I'm one of the men. No, I wasn't. I wasn't that night. No.
All right, sorry.
The Hurling Show is live and off the ball every week. It's moved to a Thursday for the final run-in, and so it was on yesterday. Jamie Wall was on this week's episode, and here's how he sees the All-Ireland semi-final replay in Thurles going on Sunday. Yeah, we're the old sound. Look at it, it's Friday, lads. We're on a bit of a sort of doing a bit of a George Bush here on the wind into the weekend. So, right, it's golf. That's where we're headed next. And I'm assured we've got sound and pictures and all of that sort of good stuff here. If you're a friend of the pod, good for you because Golf Weekly is back. Check it out if that's what you're into. Here's some Phil Mickelson goodness.
Does Monty not deserve to be in the Hall of Fame?
He does deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. For his Ryder Cup career and for being a European Order of Merit winner so
7
many
years.
Times. He's a Hall of Fame career.
Okay.
Just because he didn't win a major.
Do you disagree?
Can I leave now?
Just because he didn't win a major.
Your whole career is based around when you get to that level about winning majors. So if you've never won a major, you know, should you be in the Hall of Fame?
That's a very black and white way of looking at it, though.
But that's what majors are.
Does this Ryder Cup career not count for a lot?
Ryder Cup's only a competition. It's a team competition.
And does his European Order of Merit wins not count for a huge amount?
It counts massively in Europe, but it doesn't count massively in America.
So you don't count him as one of the great golf players of the last 40 years?
I consider him one of the best golfers in Europe for the last whatever many years. Mm. But he didn't bring that status to America and do, you know, he didn't dominate the American tour where all the best players played when he was playing. Like, Monty travelled around to European tour events in a car. And that's what he did. He went from event to event to event. He didn't play in the big events in America because he didn't like going to America. Because he was ribbed so many times on Ryder Cups and stuff like that about his weight and about the way he played golf and his extramarital affairs and whatever it may have been. But I said to somebody, we were talking about it at the Open there, about Monty being in the World Hall of Fame, and I basically would feel that the World Hall of Fame should have been around major winners and major winners only.
That was Peter Laurie in conversation with the lads on Golf Weekly. Fairly interesting conversation, it has to be said, but I'm with Peter Laurie. I mean, nothing to do with the state of Nathan's shirt. I'm with Peter Laurie on this one. I think that Monty had an excellent career. It's all couched, obviously, in a European context, in a US context, and you got to look at, when you're talking Hall of Fame, you got to look at it in the whole. It's nothing. Like, he didn't win any majors.
Like, did he have an excellent career?
Well, he was, like the lads say, he obviously topped European Order of Merit a number of years running and was a highly successful golfer. There is absolutely no doubting that, because apart from that, I guess there are so few that make it to that sort of a level. Competed at majors, could have won a few majors, didn't win any majors.
Yeah, key point. I can't believe Joe and Nathan are actually trying to argue against Peter Laurie on
that. It's
an
individual sport where that's how success is measured, ultimately.
Without question. So some would say that you need to actually win multiple majors to be considered, and that Rory McIlroy is at that level now, but Padraig Harrington's at that level. Is Graham McDowell at that level? Probably not. He's won one major. Like, I mean,
that's a good question. Should Graham McDowell be a Hall of Famer?
Well, he's certainly got more of a shout than Colin Montgomery.
It's good.
No question about it. Like that, I'm not even entertaining the idea that Colin Montgomery deserves to be there more than Graham McDowell. He's a major winner. It's simple as that.
That's an interesting question. So, to extend the point, like, McDowell had obviously, you know, more than one, but one very good week of his career where he won the Open. Was the Open? Was the Open?
No, the USPGA.
USPGA. So that puts him at a better standing than a guy who was probably, I think you could say that Montgomery was consistently better than McDowell. That's just true. That's just a fact.
Yeah, fair. But the height of the success.
Oh, but I'd agree with that. Maybe neither of them are.
It depends what the criteria is. Admittedly, I have not studied the criteria for what it takes to be inducted.
I don't think that, yeah. I think you just make it up as you go along.
I also admire the fact that every time you introduce a Golf Weekly clip, you're like, good news for friends of the pod, Golf Weekly is back. It tends to be back an awful lot.
Yeah, golf every other week. That's the story with it. Right, enjoy your trip to Killarney this weekend.
Yeah, big jamboree coming. What's your plan?
My plan is to catch up on some much required sleep.
Oh, why?
I'm not sure it's going to be a long story. I'll tell you off air.
One OTB AM does not a tired man make. No, so I'm interested to hear what the story is.
All of that coming your way, Owen. For you only in Thursday.
I'll make sure to live tweet our conversation.
Enjoy your weekend. Good morning. Good luck. OTB AM.
Thanks to Screwfix.ie. Championing the trade with a choice of over 20,000 quality trade products.
So if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.